Welcome to another edition of Sea Control, your moment of PowerPoint rehab from the Center for International Maritime Security. War games, from the entertainment of the risk board to the grand scale of international exercises, simulations of varying types and scale inform and misinform us in learning about war and conflict. For the first in a two-part series on wargaming, I jumped on board with Jeff Anderson and the CNO Rapid Innovation Cell podcast to discuss the Crix Fleet Battle School game, as well as some more general group discussion on the benefits, tripfalls, potential, and limitations of wargaming. Chris Kona joins us to discuss the Fleet Battle School game and some larger wargaming programs. Jeff nerds out on StarCraft, and I talk a little bit about the First World War. This and more after a short break. And I bring in some examples about the First World War. We'll let Jeff take it away with this and more right after a short break.
Hola nuestros amigos. Do you like Sea Control? Do you enjoy the SimSec Next War blog? Become part of the discussion and our community. Sign up for SimSec membership at www.simsec.org/about/membership to get our articles and podcasts emailed to you every week, and an account that allows you to submit articles directly to our editors through WordPress. We think Sea Control is a very fine product, but it's nothing without your constant support and engagement. Your ideas keep us going. Now sit back and enjoy the show.
So my two guests here, we have Mr. Chris Kona from NUWC, and we have Lieutenant Matt Hippel. Mr. Kona is a former submarine officer turned civilian, and Lieutenant Hippel is a surface officer still currently working active duty. So, gentlemen, welcome to our wargaming discussion on the Crix podcast. How are you doing today?
Not doing too bad. Happy to be here.
Well, great. Thanks for coming. Hey, so Chris Kona has been working on this Fleet Battle School concept, and we had him on episode 7 a little while back. If you want to check out kind of some background. But do you want to tell us, give us a refresher on what's been going on with Fleet Battle School, what it is, and why we should be interested?
So Fleet Battle School was a project that we developed for the Crix. And the idea behind it was, how do we build a game that we can use to evaluate how technology and tactics can be used in different combinations? Sort of a sandbox or experimentation bed for new ideas. So when we had put it together, we've been working, and we kind of had a product put together this spring where it was a tabletop game. And the idea was to focus on something where it was an operation level game, and you would actually be moving pieces around submarines and things, or ships, submarines, aircraft. But it was abstract enough that you didn't have to spend an entire week trying to plan moves in order to go from one place to the other. You could just, you give your orders to your troops. And in fact, the way it was designed is that each ship, you assume that your captain and their crew are actually trying to do their job right. And so rather than micromanage what each ship is doing, you're trying to move them around based on the orders that you gave them. And as situations come up where they encounter the enemy, they respond to the enemy based on the commander's intent that you gave them, whether you want them to be aggressive or more withdrawn. Do you want them to be an MCON? Do you want them to radiate and blare? And so you build these strategies at the operations level, the operational level, to put these things together. And we built it too with the idea that we wanted it to be flexible in technology. So there's essentially different capability levels. And what we didn't want to do is focus on, you just need a gadget that shoots an extra 2 miles. You need, what's the sort of general level of technology that you're using? Now, how does that affect the decisions that a commander has to make in combat? Or as you approach the enemy? And so the idea is, now you have this game and you can play through about a two-day scenario. It is about 4 hours, which as terms of war games go, is pretty short in terms of a professional war game. But it's something that you can easily get into. We played with Captain Lottiman, the Marine Crixster, and he figured out pretty quickly how to ambush me using naval air and ships. So it's something you can get into quickly and come up with some clever ideas. And at the same point in time, produce results that are pretty comparable to what you would expect in a professional war game. So at least it provides a good background for the decisions that you make.
So would you say the main differentiator is that this one is only 4 hours? It's a lot shorter. It focuses on, or that it focuses on different things. What's the differentiator between this and a classic war game?
So there's a couple of areas. One of them is the time scale. And what the Crick really wanted us to do is put together a game that JOs could play or enlisted could play in a war room setting, in the cruise mess, and just jump in and try some things out. And so it kind of gives you an idea of what warfare is like without having to do the whole investment. So the time scale is really important. The other pet piece was they wanted to do something that they could eventually crowdsource. And to do that, it needs to be unclass. And so once you have to get unclass, then you want to create these. The capabilities can't be that specific, and so it gives you a lot of streamlined parts of the game, so you don't have to worry about, you know, where each missile is flying. You can just skip to the effect, well, we think it's probably going to kill you 50% of the time, and if you have this such and such a capability, it's probably 60%. Okay, moving on to the next part. So the other big thing that we wanted to focus on is the whole technology piece and how that affects the decisions you make. So as you're introducing new technology, the fact that you have a shiny new gadget, the fact that you have this new capability, a laser, a railgun, something that can go shoot that much further, it's how do you use it? How does that affect what the commander has to do? And so that's the part that we also wanted to dig into.
Nice. So I lost my train of thought for just a minute there.
Well, so I've got a question here. So what you've sort of done, and I apologize, Jeff, if this hasn't been introduced to your audience before. I'm sure it has. CSG 360, is this sort of a simplified version of that, kind of a quick and dirty, like instead of Axis and Allies, a version of Risk, you know what I mean?
Yeah. So, in fact, CSG 360 and Fleet Battle School both were sort of born of the Halsey games over at the War College, which are these incredibly elaborate, specific games, and they're incredibly good at developing, understanding exactly how things work in war. It also comes with a 150-page game book, which is an amazing book, and they found some really intricate ways that you can leverage the environment to do what you need to do. But the idea was to bring it and make it more simple. CSG 360 is a game designed to train staffs. You want to figure out how you want to bring your CSG in, the staff, and you want them to work together through this problem to figure out how are we going to work together, us 30 people, us 15 people, how we manage to bring, to actually get through this problem so that when they actually have to go to war, they understand, I'm going to call you and I'm going to tell you I need 10 aircraft and you're going to send me 5,000 gallons of JP5 or however this, the staff interactions work. We didn't, when we did Fleet Battle School, we didn't care what the staff interactions were. We just wanted to, we figured one person on each side, let's try to simplify the details of having to build briefs and that sort of thing, and let's just get into what decisions do you have to make if you're the commander to actually create the effects that you want on the enemy.
Sure. You know, I'm going to back up for a minute to the thing that I forgot about, but thanks for the save there, LT. Is you mentioned tech, and sometimes it can be tempting to think, well, if we have something that just shoots 2 miles further, or if we have this little magic bullet, we'll finish, you know, everything will be great. And yet, one of the reasons I try to have this podcast, and one of the big things I look for in the Crick X, is not so much a technology focus, although a lot of the discussions end up, you know, around technology, but what do you do when it comes to those things, and can you use your imagination for them? You know, it's that whole, like, use your brain, exercise your brain. What would you do if you had this capability? It doesn't matter about, it's not that that capability is going to completely save a war. That's very seldom. But especially in most of our hands, maybe the atomic bomb gave, you know, President Truman a capability, but most of us are not going to come across that decision. We're going to come across much smaller decisions, how to properly set up shoring during flooding, you know, when there's not the same H-type that you've practiced with. Those little innovations day to day.
Absolutely. And in fact, the atomic bomb is sort of an interesting example, too, because there's an example of a technology that showed up and there was one particular use for it, which was a strategic bombing of an enemy to try to subdue his population. And it worked great for that case. Now, in the hands of someone else, they may not have come up with that use. And they may have tried to come up with a tactical purpose for which it might not have been useful. And there have been, you know, if you look at naval tactical nukes, has it would have had the same effect? Would you have seen the same difference? And probably not. I talked, too, about like submarines, for example, and you look at, by World War II, all the major powers had submarines of some sort that they had used. Now, each major power sought to do them differently. If you look at the war in the Pacific, the Japanese thought the purpose of the submarine was to go after capital ships. And so that's what they really focused on. And as a result, the submarines, while they did see some action, they were not nearly – they had a different level of effectiveness on the enemy as the U.S. submarines, which skipped right and went straight for the throat, aiming to go after commerce. And so depending on how you use that capability and that new technology, you'll get different results. And a lot of times you the results that you get aren't – it's not the technology that did it. It's how you looked at it. Precision weapons, they were invented by the U.S., but the U.S. weren't the ones who really figured out how to use it. It was other nations looking at us, realizing what we had, that, oh, if you had a weapon that's this precise and I have a sensor that's this precise, I can put those together. And now I can build this entire network that you see, that you hear a lot of talk about in literature, about these anti-access area denial systems. That was all stuff that the Americans came, in large part, came up with, but that other nations figured out how to use better.
LT?
You know, that's, I think... we're talking about the advantages, disadvantages of wargaming here. I think one of the critical things we need to remember is that wargames are inherently something that we conceive. So we have designed the parameters, and the flaws in our perception will always be in them. And I think one of the really great examples, I listened to Dan Carlin's Hardcore History, and he's been doing a series called The Blueprint of Armageddon. Now, you know, we have these little podcasts. Imagine, you know, a series podcast that's 4 or 5 long, each one's 3 hours, and he's talking about the First World War. And the French artillery, you know, concept, hey, what's my concept of operations? How do I war game? French build small mobile artillery, the idea being, hey, I'm going to pick up, I'm going to move, and this is going to be a really great idea, and my superior mobility will defeat the enemy. Well, Germans didn't think about that, said, I'm going to build a huge, accurate piece of artillery, and I'm going to bury the enemy. And so they had all these small, you know, these small cannons running around getting annihilated, and all the German artillery was outside of their range at the beginning. And, you know, when we war game, I'm sure the French did the exact same thing. They said, well, I did a war game. This is the concept. My enemy has really heavy artillery, so I built this thing, and because I'm inside of my perceived little world, is that this is a really good plan. And so we're going to move forward with that. And then reality sort of shatters it into tiny pieces, which is, you know, it's always a balance between convenience and accuracy. You look at something like CSG 360 and something like Fleet Battle School. Fleet Battle School is great on a certain level, but then, like you're saying, it's two different component commanders or commanders, depending on how big you want to make it, is, okay, I've got two guys. They have just instant C2 with their entire command and control. Boom, do this, do that, just like in a normal any video game. You'd never get bad comms with your units marching across the map. Yeah. None of them misinterpret your orders and go, well, some of them do, but that's mostly because the bad video game is designed poorly and some guy ends up marching into a wall for 30 minutes. But when you have something like CSG 360, you know, you're going to that next iteration where you say, okay, now there's 30 of you, and now you actually have to give very specific, not specific orders, but good commander's intent, and then you go to real life where you're like, okay, now I have to set up a comm circuit, and my IT2, you know, maybe he didn't do he's not from the proper school, but he's the one on watch, and he's trying to set up the circuits, and it's not working, and so your whole plan is pivoting on this one guy, or he's trying to set up a data network, you know. So it's the convenience for sort of operational strategic mindset all the way down to the devil's in the details. So we need to remember that, because I'm sure we have made plenty of mistakes in the past, specifically because we leave out critical components of our concept, or we blithely ignore them because we think, hey, I've got a cool, shiny new thing. Kind of like with cyber in the EW realm, is we almost pretend like this is something new, but, you know, EW's been around since radios have existed. And now we're like, ooh, we have this new realm of combat. You know, okay, maybe EW is a new medium in which we fight a war, but we've been fighting it. I'm just happy now that we now appreciate more the reliance we have on it. But again, up until this point, it's almost like we just kind of took it for granted, which is which we do. You had Van Riper on, and again, a lot of things taken for advantage, and you give a guy a little bit of rope, and he crushes everything that you put together.
Mm-hmm. And ruins $250 million. Ruins. You know, I'm using the air quotes there.
Chris, well, okay, not ruins. Teaches you a very valuable lesson.
Yes,
that
is
then,
exactly it.
You then ruin that lesson.
Yes,
so you
yes.
do that.
So I think you brought up a great point in there, which talked about trying to develop understand the resilience of how you respond. And that one of the things that you see a lot as you do a straight analysis, you can figure out where do all the lightning bolts lead. But how do you understand how resilient is your system and how do you respond when something doesn't work right? So Matt, what's your thoughts on the use of video gaming then as a way to sort of teach or at least explore resilience in command or in warfare?
Well, I mean, here's the difficulty in that, is that warfare on the tactical level is so complicated, and people observe things and change their minds and change priorities, is I think it would be actually rather difficult to make a video game that simulated a bad C2 that didn't make your units look a lot dumber than they are in real life. Because once you sort of let them, maybe something like a flight simulator, like an Ace Combat, like something like that could work, where you have some pretty straight-laced tactical and operational objectives that aircraft are doing, but then you're not in the driver's seat. I think really that wargaming in the virtual world, so us using these games, is us considering the best of all worlds. So I say, if I have perfect C2, if the morale of my troops are perfect, you know, or if they're sort of the monolithic black box, it's a unit of troops. It's not a certain number of guys with different morale, and they're at different states. Some of them are tired, some of them are not. Maybe 2-3 guys are fat, and one guy's just a beast in PT. I mean, there's so many factors that, I mean, you have to create a concept in which to put the details. You know, you don't take the details and then build a war plan based on that one guy.
Sure.
So I think there are some things we just accept. But the key is for us to understand Dutch East India Dutch East India Corporation. What's the name of the British one? I'm just going to sound like an idiot here. The British major trading company.
You mean just the East India Trading Company?
East India Trading. I keep putting Dutch at the beginning for some reason. But East India Trading Company, you know, they send these guys off, and they say, and they basically give them the full authority of the company. And the company was able to accomplish this because everyone understood that commander's intent, which is why I think CSG 360 is so important, because it forces you to understand and grapple with, okay, what will my commander's intent actually tell people to do? If I tell them to do this, and then later I go, well, they wouldn't do that. You told them to. And that's the real critical piece of resiliency. You know, you can build a network, and okay, I can shut down the network, and that'll save my ships, or that means people won't detect me. But what are your commanders doing once that network is off? And that's the critical piece, because even if you do that, let's say you've got magnificent C2, your force is still going to be more effective if they understand the commander's intent. And I think at the end of the day, like we were talking about earlier, a video game will never be able, unless it is the most basic, like if it's Risk or if it's Diplomacy or Axis and Allies, where it's very blunt numbers, pathing logics, that kind of stuff, you'll never be able to get a computer to understand. I don't want to say never. So in the near future and probably mid future, you'll never be able to get someone to understand your commander's intent. So you just have to accept that as one of the flaws in the, you know, virtual gaming.
Sure.
Unless you're going to put someone on the other end, you know, hey, if I could put a CO at the other end of, you know, video gaming and say, hey, this is your ship. Sure, his whole crew's not there, but he's got some general concepts of what he wants to do. So I guess there are ways to do that.
Have you ever played there was a Command & Conquer game out maybe probably 10, 12 years ago now, where you played at the first-person shooter perspective.
Yeah, okay. That thing
was
garbage.
How cool would it be, though? It wasn't as fun as the other ones. But how cool would it be if you had a game where you could have some people, I guess maybe Battlefield does this, right? We have some people at the grunt level that are running around and shooting stuff, and other people that are doing Command & Control. What about putting something like that together so you have... You can put the commanding officer or the admiral, whoever it is, you know, on the one side giving out orders, and then people interpreting them as they understand it, right? We talk about commander's intent, and then you say, "Well, no, I told you to do this," and you say, "Well, I mean, this happens every day in in a work center, hey, I told you to take this out or whatever, and no, you said to do this," and there's anyway. So yeah,
Chris, go ahead.
We talked about how to get at this, and I had a conversation. A friend of mine teaches business. And he has a class in business strategy. And we're trying to talk about how do you teach college students how to learn this. And so how to teach college students business strategy.
Oh, okay. Got it.
And so what we did is there's a game Power Grid. I don't know if you played it. It's a tabletop game. Is you buy power plants, and then you buy fuel, and you buy different cities, and which are markets. And then, so as you spend your money in these different things, and there's different mechanics for each one of those, and the idea is to make the most, power the most cities at the end of the game, be the biggest power company. And so the idea was, is we took a game, take a game like that, and then have your students break them up into teams. So you're playing in a class of, there's six players in a class of 24, so each player is a team of four people. And one person holds the money, one person, and he's in charge of strategy, one person goes to buy the plant, one person buys the fuel, one person buys the houses. And you send them out, you put the plan together, and then you send them out to act independently. So here's the plan. Now go in the other room. Now you have to work with the other five people buying the fuel to try to figure out how to execute how we're going to do this. And you can come up with these really complex things like, well, I'm going to undercut this guy, but it all falls apart at the end. So how do you provide orders that are simple enough to be understood that someone can go come back and do it and not screw it up or blow all your money? Or screw up the guy's plan, or has to come next, And so, it was sort of an interesting way to do it, but it's way easier to do in tabletop where you have that personal interaction. I can see how video games make it tricky.
Yeah, I like that idea, and this reminds me of the importance of skin in the game, and probably my biggest, the biggest time I actually learned this concept was in college. Just at the very beginning of when Texas Hold'em was starting to get big, and I was playing on Yahoo groups for free. You know, there's no money involved, and you go in there, and the game is just wild. You know, I mean, if you can still go to any free app on your phone, get your Texas Hold'em poker and play, and it's nothing like the real game. It is nothing. You go into a casino or a card room, and you play, and you put $200 out in front of you, and you start playing for, $5-$10 per bet. That radically changes the game, and then of course as you go up in money levels even further, the game still changes. So it's easy to make I'm not going to say it's easy for anybody who's in command to make decisions where people die. That's got to be a heavy weight, but that there's going to be a skin in the game that's going to take effect. That's not going to be there in the war game. In the war game, it's very easy to say, okay, yeah, we're going to sacrifice this destroyer, and that's going to allow the carrier to move past and do a bunch of ground attack. But in real life, I have to assume that the admirals are going to still make that decision. It's going to weigh harder on them, but they're going to have certainly a skin in the game where, well, that commanding officer was my divo back when I was a department head, and now I'm going to send him to his death. That's How do you put that into a war game? How do you
I think inherent into the war, and you'll never have the skin. I mean, we've said it a million times, and Chris Barber, Marine Corps captain, writes for us, and he had a lot of strong words about a lot of the comparison of how do you understand war with video games, and had a really good article at SimSec about understanding, video games are barely just a tool. Like, this is like war is hell and war is real, and I believe this is that the people who go into these war games, because this is their job, it's not Jimmy playing Call of Duty, it's a guy whose job understands and puts weight into those decisions. Like, hey, I am trying to build a model by which I may fight a real war. And so I'm not just one of the problems with games is how you can game games. And I don't think that people I would hope so, and I've never met anyone who thinks this way in the military is trying to game the system for a win. I'm sure it happens, but I've never met anyone who's admitted or openly said, "Hey, that's what I do." My friend JJ brought up the idea of, you know, he used to fence when he was a kid, and you know, the way that he would fence, he would get killed. Like, people would kill him, but it's a point-based system. So he would do things to irritate the other guy and throw him off, when in real life, that guy would just have stabbed him through the chest and ended his life. But he was able to keep this score really close because of the structure that they were in.
Sure.
And I don't think that people – I would hope that military leadership doesn't attack games that way. You know, say, hey, this is a war game. This is my destroyer. This is my unit. You know, these are in real life, specifically because it's their career and their job. So it's, I would hope, a lot different for them. I mean, it still has the flaws, but you have the added advantage of someone having an appreciation from personal experience as to what it is that they're trying to accomplish there.
That said, that might be more likely if you didn't have skin in the game. Because if you knew you weren't going to lose money, you wouldn't want – there'd be no incentive as much to game the system, because otherwise there's no point in being there. If you have to get your money back, then I'm going to try harder to make sure I get it.
Yeah.
I'm sort of a proponent of not trying to put skin in the game. And for me, it's how do you teach creative thought? And the idea is, can you expose people to the sort of the spectrum of decision-making before they have to get into a situation where it really matters, so that they can think through some of the things and practice the patterns of thought that are involved in trying to quickly assess a situation, make a decision, see what happens, correct, move on, and go to the next piece without having to worry about the risk, so that by the time you get into a situation where it matters, you might be a little more – you'll understand what the landscape looks like. And so, you know, to use a poker analogy – you know already whether a hand is bad or good because of you tried a bunch of times and it works. Poker analogy is bad is because when you play, people play differently when there's no money, so it doesn't, your landscape isn't true. So maybe there's something to that as well.
I think a cheap example to show that is probably, I'd say most of the people listening to this maybe play first person shooters. I mean, any guy that's between the ages – well, yeah, any guy that's younger than 30 probably grew up at some point playing first-person shooters. Everybody's bunny-hopping around, doing completely insane things that would never happen in a war, just running out in the middle of – just insane, stupid things because they're people playing a game. But people play slightly more carefully when it's not, hey, you just respawn. It's there's a 15-minute round and you have one life. All of a sudden, everybody's taking cover behind things, and it's still not perfect. You know another round is coming, but
there's a negative sanction for
there's perhaps a little bit of skin
behavior
that you can sort of torque into that game, mm-hmm. to allow people to find new things that you would never find in real life, because people are trying obviously to play conservatively. They're trying to make sure that they stay alive, their shipmates stay alive. Which is all important good instincts, but then sometimes, you know, the old ways are dead. The old ways are what kept us alive. You know, you need to open up some space for them to find new ways to operate.
That's going to be the title of this podcast. The old ways are dead. That's that is such link bait. You know, I want to point out that one of the inspirations that we had with this discussion with Fleet Battle School and wargaming was Lieutenant Jason Chuma talking about how the Madden football games had actually changed the pro football games, like people running out the clock by running parallel to the end zone line, you know, run out the clock and a few things like that. So there are things. I mean, rocket jumping is probably not one of them. But there probably are some things from RTS, from shooters, that have changed warfare. Chris, do you know of any off the top of your head, or have you seen any of that as you guys have been developing Battle School?
Well, we didn't look at that much in Battle School, but I think the analogy I would draw is, does playing Team Deathmatch on Call of Duty make you a better driver? And I think you could make the argument, this is completely anecdotal.
A better driver?
Yeah. And so is there...
Call of Duty makes me a better driver of a car. I don't...
Yeah, no, that's what I mean. So there's a situation where now you have to process a lot of information quickly, and so you can translate those same instincts to driving a car, which is another environment where you have to process and make a lot of decisions quickly and then respond quickly to them. So
you know, this is one of those reasons I make this argument with my fiance, is that my future children, I would rather them play video games than watch TV. And she's like, well, I'm like, no, TV is no longer educational. I would rather them have learned hand-eye coordination than just sit there and watching Honey Boo Boo or something awful like that. Sorry for interrupting. Sorry.
No, I have good TV show recommendations. I'll tell you offline.
We've gotten a lot of arguments over the Madden football example. And a lot of it comes back to, it's not that because they played Madden football, they had figured out all these strategies, but in playing enough Madden football, it kept them thinking about the game at a mm-hmm. higher tactical level.
Yeah.
That they were able to think through the problems and exploit them better in real time.
You know, go ahead. Sorry, finish.
So it's more about training the mind to think creatively and respond to opportunities more than identifying a particular strategy that really, you know, that was the silver bullet.
Sure. And, you know, it's first we've mentioned first person shooters, but it's really the real time strategy games that are going to the real time strategy like StarCraft, Red Dragon, that sort of thing, that are going to help people think about war, because running around with a gun, shooting things is like, okay, that's fun, but it's not, there's not a lot of strategy to it. But learning how to play StarCraft well, I know a big thing that I did was you would, like Reaver Drop back in StarCraft 1, you would load up a shuttle with this gigantic little, it's armored thing that had bowling ball bombs in it, basically. You'd go behind their defenses, and you'd completely wreck their economy. And, you know, sort of a side thing, how did 9/11 hurt us? It hurt our economy, right? It attacked one of our major centers of commerce in the United States. And, you know, it was, in some ways, it was a Reaver Drop. So,
oh, my God. Wow. Wow.
Well, glib about it, but in a sense, we are just coming right here. We're attacking your economy. We're not going to attack you.
It's attacking a different center of gravity.
Right. Exactly. We're not going to focus on the front of your base where you have all these siege tanks set up and your pillboxes full of Marines. We're going around the back and we're beating up your economy.
Have you ever been to the Jersey Shore? It doesn't look like that at all.
Yes, I have, and you're right. It does not look like that, but
You mentioned Red Dragon, and I do like the War Game series, and what I like about it so much is it brings in that, and this is why I was so terrible at it at the beginning, is I was like, why are my tanks just stopping, and why is it? Because it has a supply. Your guys have ammunition, your guys have fuel, your guys have morale and parts. So you get hit, okay, my tank survives. Now it's going to need spare parts because something's broken. And so you actually need to cycle up supply trucks and you can run out. Mm-hmm. So running out of supplies is a real thing that you can do. So it's not, I'm just going to hunker down and wait and just pound you to death or use so much artillery. Just, it's interesting. It reminds me of back to that World War I example, is they're just, hey, you know, we can fire at this rate of fire. Well, nobody ever expected to fire that many shells of artillery in such a short period of time. So mm-hmm. what they thought was stockpile enough for months and months and possibly years of conflict is just, boom, gone in a week, even though you're still producing them. You know, you're producing shells at a rate slower than you can than actually fire them. And, you know, in a game like Red Dragon, you just spend the whole game shooting artillery at people, and all of a sudden you find yourself out of supplies for everything. Mm-hmm. You know, it's not really direct. It's a cheap transition. I can't really have 1,500 points, use it for fuel, parts, or ammunition. But it teaches you a certain lesson, you know, and I think that's – you know, that's the important part is, hey, I'm the random civilian, you know, or I'm the guy who doesn't know anything about defense. And all of a sudden I'm introduced to this new concept where I have to protect my supply lines and people can steal my supplies and my tanks. And so if I run out into the middle of a field, yeah, maybe that was a cool offensive, but now I have this tank unit that is all by itself in the middle of a field with no fuel. You know, these are all things that you have to consider when you're playing the game. And kind of like I was saying before with Chris's Battle School, you know, you can learn that. C2, you can't, but supply chains and logistics, you can learn at least some of the basic concepts. And if not to come up with new ideas, a lot of these things can be used to teach. And that's mm-hmm. the important part. So you're like, you know, like in the fleet, they'll talk tactics or you'll learn how ships operate in a unit. Maybe it's hard to imagine. But if someone were to show it to you on a screen or say, now kind of control these ships, yeah, it's artificial. You would never do that. But you're like, oh, I see. Like Red Dragon's completely awful 1980s naval warfare doesn't work anything like it was. You know, you're firing anti-ship missiles at like 3 nautical miles away from dudes. Like just completely insane. But what it does teach you is it teaches you sort of the iron circle or the ring of fire, where it's like, hey, I have 8. I'm gonna turn off all of my ships, you know, because it's a computer, it does it automatically, and I'm gonna try to synchronize it so I'm firing all of my anti-ship missiles at the same time, and so the other guy has defenses, and you try to overwhelm them. So it's never gonna teach you how to fight, but it does teach you a concept. And that concept is really important.
Sure. Chris, did you find that there were any people that were better at the war game, the Fleet Battle School, than you expected? Were the Navy commanders the most successful people, or were there other folks that were the best?
What was most interesting is that when we took it at that level, the most successful people were the ones who knew the least about doctrine. And so it wasn't to say that they didn't understand how warfare worked, but once you sort of understood what the doctrine was supposed to be, it sort of pushed you into certain categories of how to do things. And then the people who didn't know what the right answer was were generally more creative. That's not to say that the experts don't know better ideas, and at some point, if you don't know what you're doing, yes, you might win once or twice, and you'll probably lose a bunch. It's more luck than it is skill, but you can get lucky if you're, you know, if you're trying to follow the formula.
So during the Cold War, this reminds me, there's this great little placard from the Logistics Operations and Readiness Division from the Army Logistics Evaluation Agency. First quote is from Russia. One of the serious problems in planning against American doctrine is that the Americans do not read their manuals, nor do they feel any obligation to follow their doctrine. Then there's a Nazi quote. The reason that the American Army does so well in wartime is that war is chaos, and the American Army practices chaos on a daily basis. And the final one is an unattributed quote. It says, if we don't know what we are doing, the enemy certainly can't anticipate our future actions.
So, okay, I want to follow up on that for a minute. Were there ever multiple iterations of the same commanders going at one another? So were there changes in doctrine, or did – for instance, if a so-called outsider won an early round, were there opportunities to rematch, and did people make up for that? Or did they?
No, we never got an opportunity to get into that kind of depth. And that's one of the things that we're looking at, hopefully being able to do with it, is be able to play through a series of it. Because the two things we want to look at, one of them is that, how does decisions change as you try to adapt to a strategy that is most effective depending on what's going on. The other one we want to look at is how do they change their force structure or order of battle. So how do the different players want to introduce new things and see how they to try to make the chances better? So we never get the chance to look past that. Most of the play tests we did were, you know, individual people, and then we have to go look with a new set. So
sure, okay, and how soon are we to getting to play this? I mean, you said it's going to be unclassified. Is it going to be available in the next 6 months for people to download or find at their local?
It'll be on Steam.
Oh yeah,
that would be sweet.
No, it's a table right now. It's just a manual game that's printed out. Mm-hmm. And so I'm happy to help provide folks with sort of the print your own version of it if they want to be able to mess around with it. We had kind of The funding has sort of dried up when we looked at how much it costs to develop a video game.
Mm-hmm.
And while the initial one goal was, oh, we want to go out and do this computer game, it's sort of the return on investment didn't really come through. Plus, the challenge we ran into is how do you get someone in the Navy then to collect all this information? And so we didn't really, you know, we hadn't found the right sponsor inside the Navy to be able to say, oh, you know, we really want to hear how different people play this game, and so we want to collect this information. So right now, it's just a tabletop version that we can help pass your way if you're interested.
Cool.
Seems like something that War College would be interested in. I mean, naturally, just an iteration just to build on the Halsey game type stuff.
Yeah, I know that I'd love to do it as a CrickX activity. You know,
I not know about this? How come I'm like Sergeant Schultz. Nobody tells me anything.
Yeah.
Yeah.
No, I think it'd be great to get a couple of beers or something at like we did Slater's 50/50 last time, but wherever. I think we'll probably do a coffee one sometime too, just in case people are intimidated by the beer thing. But
or mix.
Or mix.
Coffee.
Yes, yes. So throw down a mat, you know, get some dice and are there dice involved? The dice might.
Absolutely.
Okay,
absolutely.
Sweet. I like that, by the way. The dice will scare away the people that aren't really serious about it. So.
But it's funny, Paul Weber, who did all the design work for it, he described because the dice, when you have a computer model and you do that, then leaders will automatically be, if something bad happens, they'll assume, oh, no, your computer model's broken. It's just not supposed to work like that. But when you do the die roll, you say on a one, then you're going to die. And you roll a one. Oh, well, and they're more accepting of that probability that's involved in war than when it's a computer.
Sure. Oh, good point. And so just kind of wrap up here, Chris has this war game, Fleet Battle School, and we're going to get instructions on how to get it printed. We don't need it 3D printed, but maybe another iteration of it will have 3D waves or something. And we'll get through that through the CrickX, and also we'll get through the SimSec channels, whatever else channels are available through the article that accompanies this podcast. And Lieutenant Hipple with SimSec next week is, do you want to give a plug for your SAC?
Well, actually, no. The next week is the ASPI podcast, so our friends down in Australia will be rolling out with that.
Okay.
I'm working with Lucian right now for some Crick articles for next week. After next week, so the week after, starting on the 16th, that's going to be our Sacking of Rome week, and we're still open to articles. We're still interested in hearing what people have to say. The general idea is take a sort of historical, fictional kind of lessons learned, or it's a red teaming. So now imagine that you are the enemy. How would you attack the American global system, our force structure, our diplomatic and strategic institutions, and then how put yourself back in our driving seat. So you're driving the MiG now. Put yourself back in the F-14 and say, hey, now how am I going to defeat this guy, this villain version of myself that I've created? Sort of a way to help us to stop mirroring. We oftentimes, we like to think of our adversaries thinking the way that we do, and that leads into a lot of, you know, hey, if we just negotiate for another 3 or 4 days, well, that's how we do things. You know, other people might invade countries, and that's how they do things. So we sort of miss that opportunity to put ourselves in their driving seat or in their position, their pilot seat, and say, hey, what would I do if I was them? Kind of like those crazy kids in high school and college that play Model UN, and they get to play North Korea, and everybody gets excited because they get to act like total lunatics.
I've heard of some really odd behind-the-scenes gaming of that whole thing that I don't want to go into right now, but That's a whole new kettle of fish right there.
That's a terrible. What was that? Hey, I've heard some cool stories, but I'm not going to tell them. That's awful pod.
No, it would be like it would be like another 10 more minutes of this. So I'm going to end the conversation with one last quick question to each of you. Both of you are on Steam. We're all on Steam. Which game are you playing right now, Chris?
Right now, I'm actually working through Halo Reach.
Okay.
Okay. That's still a game.
Yeah. Well, you know, I usually don't stay on the leading edge because having the most advanced AAA game doesn't necessarily mean it's better. So by the time I make it around to those, it's usually, it's been heavily reviewed and usually something that I can borrow. But my big game on Steam is usually XCOM.
Oh, the new one?
XCOM's actually pretty good. The new one? Well, it's a two-parter, right?
So the I guess there's the Enemy Unknown one. They came out with that 50s version that just it was
no, not that one. There's an expansion pack, but
yeah, oh, the expansion pack's good.
Now we're nerding out too much. The audience is going to be like, I don't know, who are these people?
We've lost all the serious people. Yes.
Yeah.
So LT, what are you playing right now? What are the big games? What do you like?
Okay, so there's the one that's a little bit more serious, and then the one that's just ridiculous. Playing War Game Red Dragon. I really like that game. About 1,300 different units you can choose from. I think like 16 countries. You're fighting the Cold War gone hot in Asia. There's one where Margaret Thatcher does what she should have done and say, Hong Kong, stay in part of the United Kingdom, what's up? And then that turns south really quick. There is a version where the Chinese invade the Soviet Union over territorial conflict, and there's one with the Korean War. So there's a whole bunch of crazy, really interesting scenarios. The online version's a lot of fun. People, you can choose specialty militaries and countries, and they'd have different advantages. So it's very dynamic play online. And it's hard to do the same thing over and over and over again when you've got 1,300 different, like, unique units. And then the one that's just mind-numbing is Broforce. So it's a 2D...
What?
It's Broforce.
That looked good. It looked good.
Broforce. So you've got Brode, who's Blade. You got Indiana Brones. That's Indiana Jones, of course. You've got Officer John, like Officer Bro McLean, or what, you know, whatever it is, like the Brominator. So you've got each one of these action heroes that you can play in the stupid 2D scroller where everybody's this vague masked terrorist and you're jumping around this sort of unknown, unnamed jungle that's filled with these terrorists. We're to the point where you climb up, and to get to the next level, there's this dude in a suit who's the devil, and then you blow him up, and then you move on, you raise the American flag, and everything starts exploding, and you fly away on a helicopter. Totally mindless, totally stupid. But each one of the bros has a specialty. It's good, stupid. It's like popcorn covered in chocolate. It serves no nutritional purpose, yeah. Teaches nothing.
It's like Candy Crush for bros.
It's like Candy Crush for bros. Absolutely. That works.
Okay, nice. So I'm going to sign off with what I'm playing. And first of all, I want to say that if you're a listener and you want to get in, there's a pretty good SimSec Steam yes. community growing. So that's a good spot for people
mostly
who are...
just Red Dragon, though. So
okay. Yeah, well, if you want to play Red Dragon with some legal people...
We can expand it. You know, yeah. We can play some multiplayer Bro Force. I'm up for that.
or Civ 5 or something. Civ 5 is what I've spent the most time on lately. But I just got the trial version of StarCraft 2. And speaking of Chris saying being late to games, that's been like 5 years okay. that it's been out.
Cool but, story. Oh, tell it again.
Yeah, but the thing is, I'm so dang busy. So I pretty much never have time to play. But when I do, that's what I play right now. And it's
are you
awesome.
Trying to
I'm
get
really enjoying
like?
It.
Does your boss listen to this? And you're like, oh, I'm so busy. I don't have any time at home to play video games. Hey, when are my evals coming up?
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, you're so busy, man.
It's November. It's November.
My personal life. Oh, it's awful.
Yeah, yeah. If I'm too busy, I could probably stop doing a podcast, all right?
Yeah, so exactly.
That's probably the first thing he says.
Evidence. Evidence.
Yes. Well, hey, thanks, guys, for joining me today. I appreciate it.
My pleasure. Nice.
All right. We'll see you later. Take care.
Yep.
We hope you enjoyed the show. Remember to subscribe to us on iTunes or Stitcher Stream Radio. Leave a comment and a 5-star rating. However, the most important thing you can do for us is to tell all of your friends. We rely on you, the loyal listener, to get out the word and foster the discussion. Looking forward to seeing you next week. Oh, you thought I meant talking to you next week. Well, that too. But we can see you. Don't worry about it. Just remember to tell all of your friends.